Welcome to the Healing Ourselves, Heals Our Hoods podcast with your own Desiana Torres. This is a place for humbled, open, and transparent conversations with members of our own community. Here you can find diverse testimonies of the oppression and trauma faced on both individual and community levels. Do you want to validate the suppressed emotions you've never had the opportunity to speak about? Interested in breaking the silence? Then let's validate all that you feel right here, right now on this podcast. Let's go. So what's up, everybody? Thank you again for tuning in to this series. I know we're talking about educational racism and oppression that we are experiencing in our education systems. And this is a very, very, very important topic I feel like doesn't get talked a lot about, because a lot of us feel as though a lot of the educational systems that, you know, we engage in have been progressive. To be honest, there are still a lot of changes that are needed in our education systems. More so, the experiences that students feel and that they go through personally is what's really important to advocate against and for, so that we can begin to make those changes more on a macro level in terms of policy, so that we are experiencing less oppression and less inequality in our education systems. Before I get started, I just want to acknowledge some of the folks that I see joining in. I see a couple of my fellow friends that really fucks with me, and I fuck with y'all too, so I really appreciate y'all just really being present for these conversations. This is one of the last IG live series for this year, maybe, depending on how, you know, the situation goes with baby, because after next week I am deactivating my social media and I am pretty much really going to be focusing on this new role of being a mommy and really embracing that whole experience. So I'm glad and thankful that we're going to be having the IG live posted on the Instagram and also posted on the podcast, that is accessible to all who really want to tune in at your own time. Maybe some folks are at work right now, I get it, but this is these conversations are definitely going to be available to you all. So today's conversation, we're going to actually jump right into it. I'm really excited about this. I see a couple folks saying, enjoy your baby. Thank you so much, y'all. I'm 36 weeks, y'all. And if you've been pregnant before, you know, you at the end. It's kind of like at that time where you like, you need to come out. Like, I'm at that point. It's really uncomfortable, but I'm still like hanging in there right now. My belly is like growing more and more every day, to where I'm like, I don't understand how I have four more weeks left. Like, how much more is he gonna grow? So super, super excited, but super ready for him to be here. So I'm so excited that when he is here, that I get to share all his existence and his love with y'all, and just to see him like really, really grow, and to see him experience a life that I never had, and then my partner never had. We never had both parents in the household, never really seen the love there. So really excited to see all that manifest into our children. So I think that's really important. So I appreciate y'all in the comment sections. And also validating, I see the laughy emojis too, to validate, you know, the end trimester, that last trimester. It's a lot. It's a lot. But to jump right into it, y'all, today we are going to be talking about poverty and food insecurity, and especially amongst college students, because I know a lot of us experience it when we are like in middle school, or maybe even elementary school, middle school, high school, where we was like had trouble. Like, we always had those free food programs, which we're super thankful for the Black Panther Party who made that available, especially in the Bay Area. But then what happens when you start going into higher education? Like, are those still accessible to us? And so that's what we're gonna get into today. Our guest speaker is gonna be Karina Beltran. So Beltran is a Latinx educator and researcher, whose work is focused on uncovering stories that are often untold. So what I love about Beltran is that her research and writing is rooted with critical theory, as well as involving the populations within the U.S. So her recent published research actually focused on mothers who have been failed by the system through opioid addictions. In her free time, Beltran works on art focused on emotions that are unseen to many and misunderstood to others. So I'm gonna go ahead and invite her in. Let's see if Beltran is here. Okay, I see her. And what's really dope about the people that I be inviting y'all is that these are folks that I like went to school with. These are folks that I like grew with and really, really appreciate. Hey,
Hey, Desi.
how are you?
I'm good. First, congrats on your baby. I'm so excited for you.
Thank you, thank you. I'm really excited too. I'm at that phase where I'm kind of like, he need to be here, but also still kind of like trying to, embrace the journey. But I'm ready for him to be here. So I really, really appreciate that. And more so, really appreciate you even being making yourself available. I know you reached out to me. It was like, yo, I want to hop in on this conversation. And I know that you are very research-based, which is what I feel like could bring a lot of really, really good information to this conversation.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. Hopefully, I don't bore people.
I remember, so just a little history. Me and Belchad actually took a poetry class together.
My goodness.
We took a poetry class in college, and I think that's when I actually really, really started getting into poetry. And I remember me and you would sit in the back and kind of like practice our poetry together to kind of build that confidence, because our professor would make us go to the front of the class and like say it and act it out and stuff. So it was a lot, but I really appreciate you for even being a part of that journey there. To hop into the conversation, I want to know if you're able to even define what food insecurity is for folks who may not really understand what that word is or what that term really applies to. So can you start? Let's start off right there.
Yeah, so food insecurity is a situation that exists when people lack secure access to nutritious and healthy food, and then this impacts their growth and their development. So it is just not being able to access food. So we see this in a lot of communities that maybe don't have grocery stores, maybe they don't have farmers markets, maybe all they have is like the corner liquor store that has a few vegetables. Like that would be food insecurity. But to focus the conversation today, we're going to talk about food insecurity in higher education, which a lot of people know that it exists. There's a lot of research, which it's insane. There's research on it. We know it exists, but it's still happening. And sometimes students don't know what to do, or how to reach out if they are in these situations. So about, no,
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was gonna say that's really that you brought up like even the accessible grocery stores, right? Because I felt like in a previous series we did, I think it was maybe Hood Made, we were talking about how there's more access to liquor stores than there are grocery stores in our communities. What that looked like for us in school is a lot of kids would go to the stores and get hot chips, sodas, candy, and that was their lunch for school.
Right.
So I know that impacts a lot of folks going to like middle school, high school, kind of like if you have off-campus lunch or something, maybe on the way to school. But then I think the conversation is really important because a lot of times we think that when folks make it to college, that they have all these unlimited resources and opportunities to really like succeed, but there are still some struggles there. So I'm gonna let you go ahead. I know you were gonna get ready to jump right.
To go off of that, sometimes there's this misconception in our community that when we leave that community and we go off to college, that we're automatically living a better life. And that is not true at all. And we'll talk about this a little later. There are still a lot of barriers that our people face, and they're not talked about. They're not talked about when we're recruited, when I like to say when we're lured into these institutions. Is just something that we face in the moment, and then we have to deal with it there. So, going back to the food insecurity, about 20 to 50% of college students go through food insecurity. It depends on the state you live in, the college. If you're an undergraduate student or a graduate student, the numbers vary by state. And this happens because, well, one, there's a lot of stigma around poverty. And just the topic of food insecurity. People don't want to talk about it. It might be for personal reasons, like maybe we're embarrassed to talk about it, or people don't want to address that there is an actual issue going on. And you might think, like, well, why is this important? Why should we care? Well, not having access to food, not only does it impact us physically, it also impacts us socially. it might make people not talk to others because they're ashamed, or they can't go out because now they have the budget specifically for things. It impacts people emotionally and also academically. Like, imagine having to take 4 to 5 classes and you don't know when your next meal is coming. Like, not only are you hungry, but now you're stressed. How are you going to succeed in a college environment with those additional barriers? It is important to talk about.
Yeah, and I love that you're also bringing in the percentages, right? Because that's what I feel like is super important, that almost illuminates how serious this struggle is. So 20 to 50% of students experiencing food insecurities, that's a high percentage, especially like when you say, like, I love that you said when they lure us in, like when they pull us into their schools, because they send you the pamphlets and they put all these pictures on the little pamphlets of like trying to advertise their school and be like, we want you, we want your diversity. And I've been saying this for the couple past series too, like, y'all want our diversity, but y'all fail to be inclusive to those struggles that we face with the diversity that we embrace, And a lot of that is poverty. And so I know that we're gonna get into like how that impacts students on an emotional level, physical, socially too, because for me, growing up poor in a single parent household, it impacted me in high school and middle school the most when I would pretend I wasn't hungry. I would be like, no, we're not hungry. Like, we're okay. We don't want food, but you kind of see, looking around and you see folks going and buy burritos and your stomach. I mean, the feeling that I felt and that my siblings and I felt was one of the things that kind of like kept us in this stress, almost like a survival mode that impacted our studies. Because while we sit in class, we thinking about when we gonna eat. We're not even focused on the material that's being taught. And so when we go into talking about how that impacts college students, I felt like because I was such an expert now of managing through food insecurity and poverty, that I took those skills with me to college and continued them. So when I had folks inviting me, like, oh, we're gonna go to this B, I think it was like BJ's. That was the first time I ever heard of that, was in college. And I'm like, that sounds expensive. And I used to, me and my siblings, or me, some of my friends, I'd always use that, I'm not hungry, like, y'all go ahead, or maybe I'll just go, like, I already ate, but I'll go for the experience, But how does that impact us socially? And how does that impact, how we identify with ourselves and our mental health to be in places where you kind of just feel like you don't belong, or like, something's wrong there? Yeah, and so, one of the things that I feel like what people, some people might be like, well, some schools have cafeterias, so how can food insecurity really exist? And what people aren't asking is, how much does it cost to eat at those cafeterias? At our school at UC Davis, they had what's called dining commons, and it was like unlimited all you can eat once you're in there, but it costs thousands of dollars for a meal plan. And when you, for me, for instance, I was receiving financial aid, but it didn't fit my budget. I had rent, I had bills, I had my school materials, the books are super expensive. So then it's like, how can you budget like what's a necessity and what's not? And so the next question I have for you is like, what ways have you witnessed or even experienced food insecurities or any form of poverty in the college institution?
So I first heard of this in high school, but the teacher didn't call it food insecurity. So we had this avid teacher, Miss Millie, who would tell us about her college experience. And within those stories, I think she shared with us that in her last semester, her and her boyfriend would just eat bagels with cream cheese and sprouts. And like that was all they ate. And my high school self was like, that's like really, you're in the graduate school, you're funded, you have a scholarship, and that's all she was eating. I thought she was like trying to scare us. It was an avid class. They're trying to prepare us for college. But then once I got to undergrad, I actually started noticing this in students. I had a friend, she's still my friend, who had to budget everything very strictly. And I don't know if you all know, but a lot of the like bakeries and food places, they throw their food out at the end of the day. They don't donate it unless you ask. And sometimes they still say no, they throw it away. Due to fears of getting sued. Like if someone wants to get sick from like a day old bagel, like they might get sued. So what my friend would do is like after bakeries had like cleaned up and thrown their stuff away, she would go and get the bread from the trash can. Now the trash bins in Davis for the food was like a specific trash bin, so it wasn't like mixed with other things. So it's like people were conscious that this was going on, that students might be getting those like day old breads from the trash can. So they were kept in like a different bin, but like legally they were thrown away. So if anything happened, they wouldn't get sued. So that's kind of what I noticed in undergrad. And then in graduate school, because this continues forever, and I'll tell you why in a little bit. In graduate school, it was my second year, and I met this Latina. Now I go to school in Tennessee. There's not a lot of Latinas. So I met this Latina and she was like, hey, make sure you sign up for SNAP benefits, food stamps. And I was like, oh, we could sign up for them. And she was like, yeah, that's how I've been like making it these years, because they don't pay us enough to actually buy food. And in graduate school, they sometimes you get funded. So they'll pay for your tuition and they'll give you an assistantship stipend. The stipends range from like, they could go as low as 3,000 a year to 37 grand. It depends on your degree and your department. If you're in the humanities, you're going to be in the lower end. It averages to 11 grand, 12 grand. Now, 12 grand is the poverty level of the US. So if you're one person, you're making 12 grand a year, you're at the poverty level. That means you qualify for food stamps. So she got me onto that and I was like, wow, I wasn't aware that we could do this. Thank you for letting me know. And because we were Latinas, she felt comfortable sharing this information with me. I didn't see her share this information with other people. She just came to me and like told me, and I was like, cool. Like I had already taken credit cards and personal loans. This was great. And then I had other classmates in my class, just like you could tell that they were stressed, they were frustrated. And this one guy, he said, wow, I never thought that as an adult, I would be back on food stamps. Because sometimes it follows you. Poverty follows you because of these barriers, the systemic barriers and systems of oppression that continue to follow us and keep getting put on us. And you can't, like, you don't see the light out of this. And so what are the reasons that cause food insecurity? So sometimes people think it's just associated with poverty. But it's not. So sometimes food insecurity happens when you're just above the poverty line. Maybe you make 13 grand a year, which is not livable. But then at 13 grand, you cannot access those SNAP benefits. So then you end up with not being able to buy food, not being able to pay your bills. So about 58% of people who are above the poverty line, which could be just like a dollar more than what it is, experience food insecurity, and about 61% of those who are living in poverty are food insecure. And some of the leading causes of this is, one, the cost of college. It is extremely expensive. Now, out-of-state schools sometimes prefer, well, universities sometimes prefer out-of-state students. What they don't tell you is that tuition is going to like double and triple, and they're not going to provide enough funds for you. They'll again give you that assistantship, but it's sub living wage. And then you have student loans. So a lot of students are taking out loans, especially those who came from poor families, because we don't have that support. We don't have that monetary support from our families because they're struggling too. So like, where are we can't just borrow money from family. It doesn't exist. And then the cost of living, which you could all kind of see where we are right now as a country, it is ridiculous. So students are expected to live with strangers. This is something I'm not okay with. Having roommates could turn out to be a great experience, but it shouldn't be expected and forced upon. So Yeah, so cost of living, cost of tuition, cost of books, gas, car, however, transportation, however you're going to get there. Sometimes students have children, so then you get cost of daycare. You have to consider all these things when thinking about like what are college students spending money on? There's a misconception that college students just go and party, but there's a lot of us who don't have that luxury and who don't do that. It used to be that college was just for traditional students, and that meant like students who came from families who already had college education, or they're coming straight from high school to a 4-year to graduate school. Now it's about 70% of students are non-traditional, and non-traditional means these are students who are adults coming back into college. These are ethnic minorities because we're not considered traditional students. Students who are single parents. And so, even as the demographic has changed from more non-traditional students to traditional students, we keep seeing these barriers that exist for non-traditional students, which like happens to encompass those of ethnic minorities. And predominantly, this impacts women and minoritized identities, which is not a surprise. And that's kind of why, like, these things don't really get fixed.
I appreciate you bringing that point up too, because I feel like what folks don't, when we think about every system that exists, we think about who was it originally accustomed to fit. And then when we start thinking about how the numbers and the roles are starting to switch, so you said at first it was predominantly traditional students who would go into these institutions who have these opportunities to make it there, right? Whereas the folks who you listed after that, the non-traditional, which are like the ethnic minorities, the first generation college students, more of the population who are now entering into those spaces, you see that there's still that system that has never changed to accommodate the changes of the different students who are enrolling into the school systems. And sometimes what we are witnessing and experiencing is a maintained barrier when it comes to the inequality or the oppression, or like you mentioned before, a systemic barrier that is impacting students of color from being able to fully be present for their academics. And there, you're right, there is this stigma that once you make it into college, you got it. Like I talked about that last week, that a lot of my family, they saw that I was in college and they immediately was like, oh, she got money, she got this, she got, and I'm like, yo, I'm still broke. Like, I am still out here having to work like 2 to 3 jobs. And then not only that, but you have to have an internship when you're in college. Like, you have to kind of like stand out so much on your app, like on your resume. So you're having to almost be pulled in so many different directions that even the basic necessities become almost impossible to continue to almost like afford. And when you were talking about EBT and food stamps, I know that there's a stigma with that too. So me personally, when I was in college, I didn't know that we could apply for food stamps. I think it was someone who like another student of color who was like, why don't you apply for EBT? And I'm like, oh, because I don't have kids. I thought you needed to have kids to kind of qualify for EBT. I didn't know how it worked. And they're like, no, you can qualify as a student. And so I think what folks forget is that even when you qualify, there's a certain amount of hours you have to work in order, like you have to have a job while you're on EBT too. At least that was my experience when I was in college, to maintain and get those benefits. And they're like, you got to work 20, I think it was like 21 hours a week. But when you're a student and you're pulled in an internship and you have jobs, when do you have time to study? It's almost like there's a cost to these benefits that cost us more than just our time, but our mental health, our physical health. And I know that you were kind of mentioning some of that as well. So I wanted to highlight that when you said that poverty follows you. So you come from an impoverished community, you make it into this community where in your own head you think you're making it too, So it's almost understandable why people think that. But when you enter into those spaces, you start to really recognize the ways of which the system is still corrupt or still not inclusive to our struggles.
Right. And a simple response to like food insecurity could be people saying like, well, why don't students get a job? Well, because higher ed is amazing. I need to not be sarcastic. But so when you're in graduate school and say you do get a fellowship, an assistantship, there are rules and regulations for these things. So it varies by department and it varies by the head of the department. They kind of control your life. So they will give you an assistantship and that will pay for your tuition and they'll give you that stipend that I talked about 12 grand. And if you get a job outside of the university, you lose all of that. So you cannot, if you are working outside of the university, you cannot afford to let the university find out because they will remove those funds from you. And it is not only staff that might do that, faculty, professors, but also other students that are concerned about the integrity of the program. There have been, in my old department, there were situations where somebody was like telling her classmates like she got a job outside, and then a student there told the head of the department, and then that person had to be talked to about having to quit that job because otherwise she would lose the funding. So they make it impossible for you to actually find other resources because there are these rules in place. And one of my other friends who was an international student also has scholarships, also has like the assistantship. He's told me stories about international students who are not making it because they don't pay us enough, get a job, and then they lose the funding. Not only that, but they get sent back to the country where they came from. And mind you, the university kind of recruited them. So it is a very unsafe space for students to actually try to seek additional money by even working part-time. Sometimes students let their advisors know like, hey, I'm working on the weekends, but it's only like Saturday and Sunday, so it's not going to impact any of my work. It's not going to impact my classwork. And sometimes advisors are like, okay, that's fine. Just don't tell anybody else. Like between you and I, that's cool. I understand, but like don't tell other people because you can't lose your funding. So they put you in an impossible situation.
Yeah, and we have a comment from Diego that I felt like is really important to kind of speak out loud too. He says, isn't it amazing how many barriers there are for people to educate themselves? And I'm starting to think it's not coincidental. You know what I mean? Like the fact that education is something that has become more accessible to our folks over time, over many protests, over many like movements that have been created back in the day by our ancestors or even grandparents or family members who pushed for this to become an opportunity for us. And now that we're here, we're like, wait a second, like why are we still struggling? Like this still ain't fair. And so you're right, Diego, when it comes to understanding the barriers, it's really important for us to hold these conversations to kind of validate that, you know, it's not just us, because there's a lot of students who are in college right now who are internalizing these struggles as their own. And they're carrying so much shame and so much guilt about maybe where they come from or the poverty that has existed in their families for generations. And it becomes a self-blame struggle. And sometimes that embeds the opportunity for improvement to exist, because then we're thinking it's an individual problem rather than a community issue that deserves acknowledgement. So appreciate that comment so much. And then I think, Belchan, you were kind of going into that already of like being able to understand the barriers that are in place and that are also impacting many students that are preventing them from being able to focus on their education. Like we really just go in there to learn, but we go in there to really survive the system that sometimes a lot of students don't make it through.
Right.
And so, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I know they put, Diego put another comment that says that generational trauma is probably going to morph into something we probably don't fully understand right now. Yeah, that's so real. And when we think about generational trauma, I think a lot of folks focus on like childhood trauma or like, you know, trauma we experience in the households or in our communities. But to be honest, it goes all the way back to colonization. Like, that's how deep it is, because there's so much untold history that really explains why the reasons why so many barriers are in place, or why so many policies exist that are still impacting people of color or the BIPOC community from being able to be embedded, or not embedded, included into spaces where we can make those changes. We're almost seen as a threat. And that's what it became, that's what it starts to feel like when you, at least for me, when I was entering these spaces of higher education, and I, in my head, I'm like, oh, y'all got it, y'all got the wisdom, y'all got the research, because there's so much, like you said before, there's so much research on this already. But why isn't nothing being done? You know what I mean? People love to research our struggles, and then they lock it behind a password, and then now it's not accessible to even us to be able to really like go through and be like, well, what was the result of that? What's the conclusion? What can change? What can we bring forth? And so that kind of leads into my next question, which I know you were kind of already, you kind of scratched the surface already, but how can poverty and food insecurity impact college students? I know you said they're physical, the social, the educational, or academically, but how really does that impact students?
I think Diego brought up a great point, generational trauma with our generation and going through these things in college. Definitely going to unravel into something unique. So that would be like in the emotional level and how we start promoting or demoting going to institutions of higher education, because these are things that we've had to learn firsthand because some of us are first generation college students. So we just kind of learn as we go. And then when we get something wrong, we get penalized for it. And the institution doesn't admit that maybe they didn't inform you. But physically, if we are not able to eat healthy food, then we're going to start suffering physically. A lot of the time you hear about college student undergrads gaining 10, 20 pounds, and it's like a joke, like, oh yeah, you're going to gain it. Like, it's not, yeah, it's not funny because this happens. Because the cheaper food, the affordable food, may not be healthy, and that might be all we have access to. And this continues into graduate school. And sometimes when you're eating unhealthy or eating things that maybe you don't want to eat, but that's what you can afford, you're not going to feel good about yourself. It's going to start impacting your self-esteem and your energy, your motivation. Emotionally and socially, people might start like removing themselves from social groups that they feel that they don't fit in financially, or they might not talk to the friends they have because they're using EBT and they might feel like there's going to be stigma around that if somebody found out. And academically, it is so detrimental. Because now you're not getting enough sleep. So if you're an undergraduate student, you have multiple jobs, you might not be getting enough sleep to focus on your classes. Graduate students, now you're stressed that maybe someone's going to find out that you have a job and you're not allowed to have a job, which is insane. So grades start suffering. People drop out of classes. People drop out of school because they can't balance all these impossible tests. And it's not on them, but people aren't talking about it. And a lot of the time, the students that we do meet in higher education are those who sometimes their family has multiple degrees, so they were expected to go, they're funded, they have savings, their parents pay for their rent, and like that's amazing. I am glad that there's students that have all the resources available to them. But it is important for the university to know when they're recruiting diverse populations that there are going to be other barriers. And specifically in my program, a lot of the students there are married, so their spouse like is paying all the bills, or their jobs pay for the tuition, so they don't have that existing stress. And it's important for the professors, the head of the department, to understand that not all students are going to perform the best because we are all dealing with different types of barriers. And a couple of things that universities do. So there's like two main things universities do to try to battle food insecurity. So they have food pantries. Food pantries are specific locations on campus where food gets donated, either fresh food or canned food, and individuals can go there weekly or biweekly to pick up like those groceries. They also have like community gardens. I know UC Davis started doing that within like our last year or so. There was community gardens. They would plant, like purposely plant fruit trees around the campus so people could eat the fruit and vegetables that grew there. So this is great. Like that's cool. We should have that accessible anyway. But that tells me that the university knows this is going on, and all they are doing is fixing the immediate surface level problem, which is just give food to the to students. Usually food pantries have a specific date and hour that they're open. So how about if students cannot make it during that date and that hour? Then you still have those students who are facing this issue, not getting food. But yeah, so the universities, they're aware, and they do this like surface level project of kindness, but they're not addressing the real issue, which is sometimes just paying fair wages. Usually on campus, it's minimum wage. Some states have state minimum wage. Other states don't have a minimum wage, so they could get away with paying you, what is it, $7.65 an hour. Sometimes you get lucky and you have some managers who pay you like $3 more than the minimum wage. But it's still a university-wide issue that could be solved, but it's only getting addressed at the surface level.
I love that you bring that up because, so one of my forms of survival when I was at UC Davis, because what the freshman year, I think they like kind of cover it for you, or it comes with your package or something like that. So your freshman year, sometimes it's more accessible. But after that, you start looking at the packages of the meal plans, and they're like $2,000 and like up for a certain amount of meals. And then you start to really realize, like, damn, that's a lot of money, like $2,000. Like, you know, what if I could use that for rent or bills. And so for me, I ended up working within the dining commons. So I became a person who did the financials. So I was like a financial analyst for all the food places all on campus. Mm-hmm. And one of the incentives that came with that job was free food. So that's how I was able to survive a lot more, because I was able to kind of just like work and then eat the food that they provided to me. But there are students who didn't have that resource or that opportunity and who had to depend, like you said, on the food pantry programs that would exist. And I remember the first time, and what's wild is that they never tell you about this coming into the school. They don't tell you about the resources they got or the food pantries or all these programs. It's almost like if you're experiencing that crisis, maybe you'll run into it. Maybe you'll run into this resource. So I think I was walking across the quad and I've seen people just handing out like these, they look like grocery bags of food. And so I kind of walked up and I was like curious, like, you know, what's this? What y'all got? You know, when you hear free, you kind of interested already. So I was like, you know, what's in these bags? And the food that they had, they were like potatoes, spinach, apples, and I was something else, but it was like four things. And I'm like, okay, I can, a sack of potatoes, like you can kind of survive. You got french fries, you can make some baked potato. You know, you just start being so creative with the foods that they give you. And one thing that I realized too is sometimes even that's not enough. And I love that you brought up how sometimes what the school does is it really does scratch the surface. Because I feel like in order to really tackle on the issue on hand, you have to first acknowledge that the issue exists. Schools do not want to acknowledge that there's still struggles exist for their students because it kind of takes a hit against their reputation or how good they advocate themselves to be or look on their pamphlets that we were just talking about. If schools, especially students of color, were to hear like, yeah, you can come here, but you know, food-wise, you're going to be experiencing poverty still, and you're still going to have a lack of access to to healthy foods to really survive here, students are not going to go. And because it's like, why continue to involve myself in that struggle? And I think this also highlights that, like, schools really are, especially like big institutions, they really are for profit. Because like you said before, I used to be a part of the team meetings with all like the dining commons and the folks who were like build housing on campus. And they were attempting to rebuild. I think they were gonna knock down a building and they were gonna rebuild a building for the students who came from international students. And they were having this meeting and I'm the only like student in this meeting. And I'm listening, and they're like, yeah, it'll bring in so much money and it'll do this and all these benefits that they're focused on. And I'm like, I raised my hand and I'm like, so what are we doing for the low-income students? And it was quiet. And I'm like, for real, like, we're building all these housings and we're trying to charge, international students double the tuition and double the rent and all this stuff. But what programs do we have for students who y'all are also inviting who are struggling with like finances and a low income programs? What housings do we have there? Because in Davis there was no rent control either. Landlords can charge whatever they want for whatever amount they want to increase at all the times like that. And so it became such a struggle for us to, again, like you mentioned, be able to maintain ourselves and really balance out everything, the education, the finances, the rent, the bills, and the food, like that's too much. And you're right, you do see such a dropout rate amongst your friends. They're like, I had three other students from my high school who went to UC Davis, and I was the only one who graduated. I was the only one who stayed. And I understand why they left, because it's a fight. It's such a fight, it's such a struggle. And so I know that you said, like, because one of my questions is like, are the programs that are existing in the education system now, are they successful? And the answer is, are they? I don't know, because they are helpful, but are they really tackling the issue?
I don't know either. I don't know how they test this. They should be checking in on these programs. I think it, as long as people show up, they say it's successful. But like you said, universities don't tell you about these programs. Like here and there, we'll get an email. So you have to check your email to make sure that you're up to date with everything. But professors don't talk about these programs or these issues. Other students don't talk about these programs or issues. So as long as nobody's talking about it, then who are these programs helping? And in terms of poverty, our university also has like a professional business attire donation shop where people donate gently used professional attire for graduate students because, again, the university knows if you're going to require professional attire, then you need to kind of provide something because it's expensive to find professional attire, although it's really boring. But yeah, I don't think that these programs are that helpful if students are not aware of them. And some systemic issues, or how do we address this systemically, is well, one, the university has to acknowledge that this is going on more so than just by having the pantries open, but by providing more affordable housing for undergraduates, maybe affordable housing for graduate students, pricing the food fairly, actually providing healthy food options within the campus. And having living wages, which sounds like common sense, but it seems to be a countrywide issue. Having living wages, and that is more than the 12 grand or 15 grand that they might give graduate students and just expect them to survive somehow. Now, at a personal level, like what can we as individual people do to kind of help out or address this is just by bringing it up, just by talking about it, bring it up in your classes. When you have a new class, even if you're not the one going through this, maybe you asking the professor, like, hey, what resources are available for like low-income students? Maybe someone else in the room who needs these resources will now have access to that information. Or requesting department heads to talk about this or have their faculty talk about these issues. Me personally, because I am in higher education and I do hopefully plan to go teach in higher education, and I was telling my friend, I'm just like a dumb optimist that eventually the system is going to change. But at an independent level, when I teach and I have students that I'm in charge of and they're under my care, because this is all like it's a caring profession, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. I don't grade attendance because I think that's unfair. Sometimes people can't show up to class, and that is okay. Whether they want to tell me why they didn't show up or not, that's on them. They don't have to give me doctor's notes. They don't have to justify their absence. If they don't trust me, that's fine. If they trust me enough to tell me what's going on, then I welcome that information. But I also provide snacks. Now, when my classmates from my graduate cohort found out that I provided snacks, they were like, "What? You actually went through with something that you said you were gonna do when you taught?" And I was like, "Yes. Why would I not?" And I've told my students, like, I just bring, well, in the beginning of the term, I do a survey. I ask about their favorite snacks. I ask if there's anything in their life that they would want me to know about. So I kind of know their situation if they want to share. All my surveys are anonymous, so they feel comfortable sharing information like that. And then throughout the semester, I buy snacks that they listed on the survey. Then I just bring a big like gift bag full of them, and then I just pass them out in the class. And I'm like, "Hey, if you want a snack, grab it. If you don't, that's cool. Grab as many as you want. They're here for you." Because I understand being an undergraduate student or a graduate student who has classes back to back and you don't have time to eat or you don't have the money to eat. A snack is like such a simple like fix. It doesn't fix the problem, but in that moment, in that class, at least you have something to snack on. And that's what I do at an individual level.
And that's what the work that you're doing is so impactful and so empowering that sometimes we dismiss it as it being like a micro level form of treatment or just a form of resource. But in reality, what you're doing is acknowledging that that is a struggle that students face. And by providing that resource, what you're also allowing is for students to be able to come and be present. Come and just learn. Come and just, like not worry about the clock and the time ticking and when you're going to have your next meal or hear your stomach growling. And these are all real experiences that the majority of students kind of go through. And so some of the things that you were mentioning that I want to bring up again that were what the institutions can do is acknowledge that this is a struggle that is going on because we can't make changes on any kind of level unless there's acknowledgement, right? Also, you said even making housing affordable. That's another way. If housing was more affordable, students would be able to afford food. And so another thing that you also mentioned was having the living having the wages be at a level to where people can actually live off of and not just like barely survive or live paycheck to paycheck off of. Another thing is like providing snacks. So I think if all schools made it to where every classroom can provide snacks, I think that'll definitely be beneficial and helpful to the students to be able to be present as well. I mean, especially considering how much they charge per student, per year, per two, like they making money, y'all. If we can afford to barely survive at the dollar store with the snacks that we get there, they could probably do a lot, a lot more than what we can. And then also the form of advocacies that you were bringing up is like providing resources, connecting folks to the opportunities or the programs that are existing at the education system. And I think the way of how that's handled is could be different too, because like I mentioned before, I was a poor student going into the school without the knowledge of these programs and resources existing. And what if they were to kind of highlight all these programs in existence during orientation? Like that could be a connection that could have been made before the crisis occurred, rather than it being more crisis. Okay, here's the crisis, here's the program, instead of like, here's all the stuff that we offer. Another thing that I really appreciate, and I know you're so research-based, which is what I love, because that's the macro work that's really important to bringing forth those changes, is having the school do a school-wide survey to allow students themselves to address or acknowledge any concerns or struggles that they're having, that the college level can be able to make those changes for and accommodate for. And that's not something that we see. The surveys we get is, you know, how was your teacher, this quarter or semester? How was the class? How did you like it? How was the material? But never, how was your experience here? How can we as an institution better fit what your needs are as a student? And again, it's about the questions in the space that would allow for us to advocate for ourselves and to advocate for a change or for more support. And then there was another point that you brought, that if students are coming in to learn and there are barriers that are impacting the learning, that should be the school's responsibility, right? Like, that should absolutely be the school's responsibility, because if we're you invited us into these schools and we're still struggling to even survive or to make sure that we're eating, your grades can definitely drop. And I'm a person who I can say, like, I mean, you know, I was working two jobs. I was the president of our internship program. And after all that, you got to go home and study. But by the time I got home from working and from internship, I didn't want to study. Well, not that I didn't want to, I was too tired. And my grades did take a hit. People think I'm so smart. Like, they see me as, like, Desi graduated from UC Davis. I'm like, barely. Like, my GPA will really indicate how barely I made it, to where I almost dropped out my senior year too, because I was so overwhelmed with trying to balance everything that it does take a toll on your mental health too. And so how, at least one question I have for you, I know we have a couple minutes left, is what would you recommend to assist with poverty and food insecurities amongst college students right now? So I know there isn't that acknowledgement yet. There isn't, you know, those surveys that are being done. So based on your experience, what can students do right now to help themselves manage through that?
I would suggest that they reach out to people that they trust. So faculty, staff, maybe that they trust, other students that may have a similar background than them, to see if there are resources, because it might be that other students are facing the same thing, but nobody's talking about it. Also, just do your research. I know it's hard to access these things when you don't even know what questions to ask, but see what is available for you. So like with the SNAP benefits, if you're one person and you're making under 12 grand, you qualify for that. And you would just apply, then you get a caseworker who calls you up, asks like 3-4 questions about your income, if you work or not. And then you get the benefits and you get like 150 or 250 a month for food. You could use that at local grocery stores or even on Amazon sometimes. So, because right now the institutions are not going to do much other than provide that pantry. So be aware of when that is offered. If you can't personally go there, or maybe you're embarrassed to go there, ask one of your friends. See if they could step up for you and show up for you that way. But other than that, we're pretty much on our own for a while until these big changes start happening.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that's why I appreciate you even coming forth to really advocate and bring forth those percentages and those numbers of students who are really at risk for experiencing these food insecurities and the extreme levels of poverty that are really going through in higher education. Because again, there's that stigma that once you make it there, that you're good. You know, in reality, I think what's being missed or dismissed is that a lot of students are still struggling at high levels that are very concerning, that are impacting their ability to really connect to their studies. And so when we are seeing high numbers of this and we're not seeing a lot of advocacy or maybe a lot of changes being done, it could potentially be that the conversation isn't being brought upon and that pressure isn't being put onto the schools and education systems that can bring forth those changes. And I know that, I was gonna say, like, there's so many movements that exist now for many other different reasons in higher educations. And what we recognize is they still don't listen. You know, like sometimes you can protest in front of the school and still say, like, you know, we need these changes, and sometimes you still don't see it. But what's important, y'all, especially the students who are maybe in college right now or those who already graduated, who were surviving off of them ramen noodles, them hot dogs with the sandwich bun, I mean the sandwich breads, like, you know, that there are things that we have experienced that deserves so much advocacy. So even you being able to showcase and speak up and share those experiences help bring forth that validation for other students who are currently going through it to kind of speak up as well. And so I believe that the community conversation is really important. Something that I really recommend too as a form of advocacy is getting a group together and just having a space where students can, especially BIPOC community, can come together and engage in these conversations about what struggles they are collectively experiencing in their education systems. That way, we're not only just addressing what the problem is, but coming up with some potential solutions on what can help us survive the school system, and then pushing forth those agendas or those demands onto the school, and kind of tell them, like, yo, you want us here? This is what it's gonna take for us to stay here, you know? And allowing for ourselves to feel so confident in that advocacy because our experiences deserve it. Our struggles deserve that. And we definitely want to create an education system that is progressive so that when our children, if they decide to go to college, don't have to continue to experience those same systemic barriers that are impacting our learning.
Yeah, and this has been an ongoing problem in higher education for a while. So if you remember my high school teacher sharing those stories, she got her degree in like the 80s. And we're in 2022 and we're still facing the same issue. And of course, she is also a person of color. So it's like, is this a coincidence? No. These are spaces that were not created for us and are still trying to push us out.
Definitely. And we're not gonna allow them to keep pushing us out, y'all. Like, just as much as these spaces may have not been for us before, they're gonna be for us now. You know what I mean? And so we gotta continue to push ourselves to really, again, advocate on those struggles that we're experiencing and those highlighting those barriers that are existing so that we can combat against those percentages that are already predicted of how we're gonna be impacted. And being able to understand how research is so important. If you're in college now and you got that email that at whateverschool.edu, you most likely have access to research that is normally locked behind a password. So being able to kind of download or get into the researching of, you know, what has already been done, what already has been talked about, what solutions have already been, you know, kind of hinted that could help combat those issues is our way of being able to fight that too, because there's unlimited amount of research that is existing that already highlights that. Like Belshana mentioned, you know, your teacher experienced this in the 80s. So how are we still experiencing this now? You know what I mean? That's a struggle and that's a problem. And it definitely needs some addressing. And so I really appreciate you for, I know we got a minute left, but I really appreciate you for being a part of this very important conversation, and I really hope that folks who have maybe been in college or who are going into college, and if you're listening to this, to really understand that that wasn't a struggle that you only went through. And maybe at the time you might have felt that way. Maybe at the time you were embarrassed to swipe your EBT card, or maybe you were the student who was like, you know, I'm not hungry, and you got so used to using that excuse to kind of protect yourself from how it made you feel socially amongst other students who did have it like that. And the struggles, the experiences, how it made you feel emotionally, how it impacted you physically if you were only eating and having access to unhealthy foods, it's so real. And so we really want to appreciate you for being a part of this conversation with us. But more so, Belchan, I really want to appreciate you for making this such a conversation that is accessible for everyone who's tuning in and listening to this.
Well, thank you for having me, Desi.
Of course. Is there anything else that you would like to offer to those who are listening before we close off?
It's a struggle out there, but we need to invade these spaces and take up space, never be embarrassed of what your situation is, because as Desi said, it's not your fault, it's a systemic oppression that's continually going on.
Definitely. And when we come together, y'all, we powerful. We powerful in numbers and experience. So allow for yourselves to not be ashamed of that no more. Like, that shame wasn't yours to carry. That shame and the guilt, that belongs to the school. So let they asses carry something. You know what I mean? I just want to say to those who are tuning in now, we have one more IG live next week. And this one is going to be also just as important. We're going to be discussing ethnic studies and barriers in our current curriculum with David Flores, who is an educator and mentor in Pasadena. So be tuned for that next week. That's going to be next Friday at 6 o'clock. We'll be posting the flyer next week. That's our last IG Live and Lost podcast series for, I don't know, I don't want to say this year, but maybe that's where it's at, because there's so many more conversations that I'm going to prepare for that we're going to come back and engage in. But for the most part, y'all really tune in and really make sure that y'all getting in this information and passing it on to other folks. Share the podcast, share the IG lives to folks who you feel could really benefit from these conversations. And let's allow each other to continue to feel so empowered, inspired, and encouraged to go out there and make a difference for our future generations. And so I appreciate y'all so much, and have a safe night, y'all. Like, I hope y'all really celebrating yourselves this weekend. Be safe, and don't forget to take your deep breaths, because sometimes we're too worried about trying to survive our world right now that it becomes a little heavier. So I appreciate y'all. Much love, and I'll see y'all next week.
Thank
Bye.
you again for tuning in with my podcast, Healing Ourselves Heals Our Hoods. Don't forget to subscribe and turn on your notifications for future episodes that will be full of authentic storytelling by members of our own community. You can find me on Instagram at CONFI_DEZ. If you haven't already gotten your copy of my poetry book titled The Becoming of Her, be sure to get yours today. We forget that reading is just as reflective and powerful. I'm sending lots of love and peace and light to you all. May we continue to heal ourselves and each other every day.